This is Carrie Stewart from Dallas, Texas, and today we're going to talk about engaging white people in working for racial justice, ending racism and white supremacy. And this is Race, Violence, and Medicine.
Perfect, Carrie. Perfect. Welcome to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I am Dr. Brian H. Williams, and today we're going to have a fascinating conversation. I hope they're all fascinating, but as you know, I am striving to get people to have open, constructive conversations about the legacy of racism. And the conversations are different for me as an African American speaking with other African Americans or white people or various ethnicities. So today I thought it'd be interesting to talk to a white woman who is unapologetic about stepping up for racial justice and how she engages other white people in that discussion. So our guest is Carrie Stewart, who is an intercultural communication consultant from Dallas, Texas. And my friend, Carrie, welcome to Race, Violence, and Medicine.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be with you.
All right, Carrie. So before we get to the meat of our discussion, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So I have been working in anti-racism and what we called back in the day diversity training for almost 25 years now. And I have gone about it in different ways over time. You know, we started out where we focused on kind of the impacts of racism and what do we do about the situations with people of color and the disparities and discrimination and, you know, how do we get more inclusion in our workplaces, where we live, where we worship, how we socialize and that kind of thing. And it's really evolved over time to be about, well, you know, this structure was set up to benefit white people. And at the core of that is white supremacy culture. And so now I really focus on how do we undo racism by ending white supremacy culture. And I really have come to understand that it really is a white people's issue. Although it impacts people of color, it really is up to us white people to end this system that was set up for us.
All right, Carrie. So right away, you've already said several words that I'm certain will shut down a conversation with a lot of people. You said white supremacy. You mentioned white people being being a white people's problem. You talked about back in the day it was called diversity, but now it's called something else. So I want to unpack all that as we go forward. So let's first discuss, like, how do you broach that conversation without someone just shutting down and walking away?
Right. So what I've really come to understand, and this goes to my intercultural background. I studied cross-cultural communication in school, and I really have learned more and more, more deeply as time goes by, how embedded our cultural upbringing, our socialization, our conditioning is. There's a great quote from an anthropologist, Edward Hall, who's kind of one of the fathers of cross-cultural communication, who said that culture is largely hidden, most so from the people who are in it. And that's one of my favorite quotes. The second one is Geert Hofstetter, another founder of cross-cultural communication, who said, if the mind is hardware, culture is the software. And it really is, culture is our operating system. It's how we work. It's how we operate. And so I think that understanding that goes a long way to understanding the way we as white people were brought up and to understand that race is something someone else has. So we are not educated about race. We don't have to think about race. We don't have to talk about race. Race, like I said, is something other people have.
Right.
And so it's about beginning to understand that, yes, white people do have a race and what that means.
So the second quote you mentioned, you said something is the hardware and race is the software.
No, if the mind is the hardware, culture is the software.
If the mind is the hardware, culture is the software. Okay. So what exactly does cross-cultural communication training involve?
So it involves understanding how the culture, metaphor or graphic that's often used in talking about culture is the iceberg metaphor, right? Where 10% of culture is something we can see and observe, like food, language, religion, dress. And 90% is what we can't see, which are all of the values, the norms that we learn, you know, just from our families and our surroundings as we grow up. It's not something that's necessarily always directly communicated, but we learn through behaviors, corrections, that kind of thing. And so most of that we call implicit culture, and which is largely unconscious. So we are raised in a race-conscious society, right? But white people are not taught about their race, right? We're just taught that our race is just normal. You know, that's what the norm is. That's what the standard is. So we don't have to learn about it. So consequently, we are racially illiterate. We are not equipped to handle conversations, which is why some of the words that you pointed out that I said will shut down people in the conversation, because white people are not practiced in talking about race as racial people.
Right. Okay. So I think race conscious, I like that term because it acknowledges that race is important in our conversations and our interactions, but I think it also allows people to have the discussion without trying to defend themselves and saying that I am not racist, which I feel is the knee-jerk reactions many white people will have when you try to have this conversation about the impact of race on people of color.
Right. Right. This is why Robin DiAngelo's book, White Fragility, and, you know, and her coining the term white fragility is so useful in the conversation for white people, because she does a great job of explaining how we got to be this way. And so we're, through the different periods of our history here in the U.S., and particularly post-civil rights, you know, the worst thing you could do is call a white person racist, right? Because we've gone so far as we know we're not supposed to be racist. But that didn't do, you know, 100% at eliminating racism, as we well know. And so instead of actually doing that work, it's kind of like we set up a facade that if you tap it, it just crumbles, right? Because we really don't know how to talk about being not racist.
Right, so that's the overt racism that the images that have impact, especially from the civil rights era, of the dogs and the water hoses and the separate but equal facilities, that is gone. But beneath that, there's this culture of the legacy of racism that still impacts, I mean, I would say nearly every aspect of society, whether it's education, economic opportunity, jobs, healthcare, politics. So when you mentioned white fragility, go ahead.
Well, yeah, as we know, there's this whole structure, right, behind those overt acts that are set up to advantage some people at the disadvantage of other people, according
right.
to racial group. Yeah.
So there's structural racism, and you do not have to be an active participant in that to benefit from that.
No, in fact, it's an evil genius. It is self-replicating, and in fact, unless you do something to interrupt it, it will continue as is.
So how do you have that discussion? Because there are people that just will not accept that is even a thing. To them, it's it's something made up, and it absolves them of any responsibility for what is happening to people now that are still suffering as a result of these structures that have been around for hundreds of years.
Yeah. So I think it's really, really important to understand the history. And, you know, we are not very good as a society at remembering our history. And that is very much a part of white supremacy culture, right? Because if you think about how this country was set up, right, it was but when Europeans landed here, they stole the land from the indigenous folks and committed genocide against them. And then they kidnapped and enslaved millions of people from Africa for free labor. So the reason this country got rich was because of free land and free labor for the folks who were able to dominate, right? And yet at the same time, this country was founded on wonderful ideals like life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and all men are created equal, and, you know, justice for all. And what we've never done is resolve that dichotomy. We've never confronted, you know, the dark parts of our past and reconciled that with our ideals. And go ahead.
No, go ahead, Gary. Go ahead.
If you look at places where they have had atrocities, you know, South Africa, Germany with the Holocaust, and even Rwanda, they have confronted the evil and the hate and the racism of their past and tried to move forward after confronting that. We as a nation have not done that.
And we're still fighting to keep up Confederate monuments and schools and some places have holidays to, you know, just avowed races.
Yep. So. Yep. Sadly, that's true.
Now, how did you become so vocal about this work? Was there some seminal event? Did you evolve? And the second part of that question is, how has this impacted your relationships with your friends and family?
Sure. Well, so it's interesting. My father was born on a farm in Tennessee in a county, I kid you not, White County. And and when he was sort of a pre-adolescent, his family moved up to Detroit to work on the auto assembly lines. And my grandfather was the kind of guy who was sort of racist in theory, but not in practice. I remember I was a child as young as 5 years old hearing the N-word between he and my uncle, you know, and going back and forth. And even at five, I understood that this was wrong, that this was hateful. But yet my grandfather was a shop steward, and I would go places with him, and he was the kind of guy who never met a stranger. He would shake hands with anyone. So there was, at that young of an age, I understood, wait a minute, you know, this doesn't quite fit. And it was really my father who sort of rejected that outlook. And I've asked him why, and he doesn't really know the answer to that, about why he kind of rejected those attitudes.
Now, was it a vocal rejection or just in his behavior? Like, how did you know? Did he turn to you and say, that is bad? Or did he just conduct himself in a way?
He didn't talk about it. He just conducted himself in a way. He is also a kind of person who never met a stranger. And he has friends, of all kinds. And we moved, when I was five, we moved from Detroit and we moved to Philadelphia, where he then went to graduate school. And while he was in graduate school for education, he was the headmaster of an independent school in Philadelphia. Now, this was during the 60s, so part of this is all his timing, right? So this independent school drew from the entire Philadelphia metro area. So the school was very diverse. And so I grew up, you know, at a young age, I went to elementary school with a diverse group of people, both, you know, racially, culturally, religious. And so that was part of the background. Plus it was the 60s, so it was the civil rights movement. My parents were young. They were in their, you know, early 20s, mid-20s during this time, and were active in the peace movement and the civil rights movement. And finally, I think it was because we were members of a Unitarian church at that time.
Right.
And so for me, my spiritual development, my religious formation was that justice was at the center of my religion and my faith. And so all those things kind of conspired to kind of become my core sensibility about racial justice in the U.S.
Right. So your father being setting an example, your upbringing in a diverse community, and your religion and faith kind of set the foundation for you having an inclusive mindset when it came to race.
Exactly. Plus, I was always kid in the class who would say, "Wait, that's not fair."
Right. Okay. So you were speaking out at a young age.
Yes.
Well, I think it's important. You mentioned at age five, you were aware that that was not right. So we got to give our children credit that they are much more perceptive than we think they are at a very young age. And what we're saying and doing is having impact upon them.
Absolutely. We know that children, you know, as young, at least as young as three, are able to differentiate not only race, but there are the connotations of different races in our society.
Well, you mentioned white fragility, the book. Do you have any other, like, what resources would you, as a white person, recommend to other white people to get them to feel comfortable about having this discussion about racism? One, getting them to talk, one step. Two, getting them to speak up about it when they see racial injustice.
Right. So it's definitely not just, you know, the education piece, not just learning about racism, but it's also learning to act, as you imply. And so it's really important for white people to get together with other white people and unpack what this means, and to build solidarity, you know, around being anti-racist. It's not enough not to, you know, not to be prejudiced or not to discriminate or even to not be racist. You've got to be anti-racist to interrupt this. So Robin says in her book, you know, it's really – not productive to spend a lot of time wringing your hands wondering about whether or not you are racist, because you are. We've been raised in a racist society. So spend your time and energy on figuring out how to undo that. And so
so what do you say to somebody that says, what do you say to a white person that says, "I'm not racist, I've never done anything, you know, maybe my ancestors did something, but that's not me, you know, I don't have racism in my heart." But they're passive. They don't speak out when they see injustice. They let their friends say and do things that you know are either implicitly or explicitly racist. How do you get to that person?
So my first mentor in the work was Carl Heath, who was a Unitarian Universalist, who invited me to start doing workshops with him. And he used to draw a great chart on the board during our workshops. And there are four quadrants. And, you know, one is it's active or passive, and racist or anti-racist. And the thing you can't be is a passive anti-racist. There's no such thing. So if you don't do anything, the system is just going to keep going. You don't have to actively be a racist or not, but you have to be an active anti-racist in order for things to change.
It's that the Nelson Mandela who said, if you do, how to go, if you are silent in the face of oppression, you are siding with the oppressors.
Exactly.
It's the same sort of idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
As we're closing up, Kara, we spoke a lot about, like, individuals and what they can do as far as being anti-racist. We kind of touched about structural racism. So what you're saying is that the structures to be dismantled so that there is equity for all will require actions by individuals. But these are individuals who may not understand, appreciate, or even care that these structures exist. how do you make them say that, yes, this is a real thing. It is not made up.
Yeah.
Structural racism is a thing.
Yeah. So Ann Braden, who was a white civil rights worker in the 60s, has left a legacy for us saying that, you know, we have to gather white people to work for racial justice as if our lives depended on it, because truly they do. And it's that mindset that there is a mutual self-interest in ending racism and white supremacy, because it dehumanizes us all, white people included. And so the leaders who have sort of followed Ann Braden's example 10 years ago formed an organization called Showing Up for Racial Justice. There are chapters all across the country. And Surge is working at mobilizing white people to get a critical mass of white people working for racial justice. And in that, there's an education piece, there's a reflection piece, and there's an action piece. And I think if we can just influence and organize more and more white people to understand that working for ending racism and white supremacy is in their mutual interest, then I think we can make a big impact.
There you have it. Racism impacts us all. We all have, no pun intended, skin in the game to make this world better for everyone.
It's literally
and like
true.
You mentioned, critical mass. I just gave a keynote speech at a conference called Critical Mass Gathering, which was about getting a critical mass of medical students of color to enter into healthcare. Particularly black men, since there was a dearth of black men in medicine. So that
right.
term critical mass resonates across different areas in trying to achieve equity within American society.
Absolutely.
Gary, thank you so much for being on my podcast. I know that listeners are going to enjoy this discussion.
Hello, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Now, if anybody wants to contact you afterwards, how can they reach out to you?
Sure. So my company is One World Consulting, and you can find me on Facebook.
One World Consulting on Facebook. Gary Stewart, intercultural communication expert. Did I get that right, Gary?
Sure.
Okay. One World Consulting on Facebook. Gary Stewart. Thank you for being on the show. And I also want to thank you for being a subscriber and listener to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I know you're listening, but your family, friends, and colleagues may not know of the show, so please share it with them. If you're on iTunes, leave me a 5-star rating. I'd be most appreciative. And as always, you can reach me at BrianWilliamsMD.com. Send your comments, suggestions, and critique. So I always want to make a show that is worth your time. Until next time, this is Race, Violence, and Medicine.